Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 11th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Bruce Berner. Today's session number is 98-9, and it is titled, Look Out, Tort Reform is Headed Right at You. Let's listen in.
How are all of you? Thanks for coming in this beautiful sunny morning. To talk a little bit about tort reform, I think we advertised this under the heading, Look Out, Tort Reform is Headed Right at You. My theory is that tort reform is indeed headed right at you. What I'd like to do this morning is kind of divide the talk portion into four subheadings. Anytime you have a question, please jump in with the question. If I don't see you right away, it's because I'm blinded by the way this room is set up. We would never set up a room like this in law school. We would set it up so that it's uncomfortable for the students. And so I can see everything, and they maybe have trouble seeing me. So please jump in and do that if you want. And then we'll have a kind of a general discussion time at the end. The four subheadings are, first of all, what are the criteria by which one might judge whether a system for compensating accidental injuries works? Okay. We all know different systems. We're going to talk about the tort system, private insurance systems, public insurance systems, workers' compensation. There's a variety of ways that we go about compensating people who are hurt by accidental injury. And everybody has their own favorite, and everybody, it seems these days, has a new scheme for how to do it. But I think we always need to start with what kinds of things will we require the system to do. You can't tell if a system is going to work unless you can develop some criteria on what a system has to do, right? Engineers know that first. And what people often find is their pet system, which sounds so good at doing two or three things, fails miserably at doing some other thing. What that means is you would have to add to that system some way of dealing with this other problem. So we'll do that first. We'll look at the criteria. Then we'll look at the major systems that are operating today and what their main components are. Then we'll look at what I call the first wave of tort reform, things that have happened and been happening over the last 10 to 15 years, how the law is changing about accidents. And then fourth, I'll give you my prediction about what the second wave will look like and what the sort of major change that's floating at us might contain. Okay. Any questions before we start? Tort is the word. Here's my casebook for the course, first year course in torts, called Torts and Compensation. Tort generally means any civil wrong. So we differentiate it from crime, which is a wrong against the public in general. A tort is the wrong against a private individual, which gives that person a right to sue. A tort comes from the French word meaning twisted. So I don't know what you want to make of that. Maybe it's the lawyers who are twisted. Maybe it's the system. I don't know who's twisted, but that's the derivation. But torts covers also intentional torts, and I don't want to talk about those today. I want to talk about accidents, people who are hurt as a result of accidental injury. Torts also includes intentional torts. And here we get a tremendous overlap with crime. OJ, remember him?
Yeah.
There was a criminal trial for homicide, and when that was over, there was a civil trial for what? What was that trial about? You remember?
Wrongful death.
Wrongful death, which is a tort, but what was the wrongful death based on? Battery. And battery is one of the five classic intentional torts. So very often when we have a crime, we also have a tort. Not always, but there's a terrific overlap. But the tort then is almost always an intentional tort. What we're talking about now is a system for dealing with the problem of accidental injury. Here are the five things that scholars generally agree a system needs to account for one way or another. First of all, fact finding. That is, how good is the system at finding out the facts that it needs to have to compensate properly? Now, what facts you need is a function of how you design the system. Let's take two quick examples. In the tort system, as we have it now, which requires proof of fault. You can't win a tort case as a plaintiff unless you can show that the defendant did something wrong. Well, that means the system has to design a way to determine whether or not somebody did something wrong. And that's often a very complicated matter that all swirls around this word we call negligence. And that's all about risk. What's a reasonable risk and what's an unreasonable risk? You walked across the road to get here. You took a risk. But presumably you decided it was a reasonable risk. That is, the payoff for coming was worth running the very small risk that a bus might run over you. By 11:30, you'll know whether the risk was worth it or not, right? Maybe it wasn't, right? But that's, risk is always that, sort of this trade-off thing. But let's take workers' compensation. Many of you know how that system works. You don't have to prove that anybody was at fault at all. All you have to show is you were hurt on the job. If you're hurt on the job, you get money. It doesn't matter whose fault it was. Could have been your own. Doesn't matter. System doesn't care. So one thing to look for is how much does the system need to know before it directs compensation? And in a sense, the less it has to know, the more efficiently it might work. I was thinking on the way over here, let's have a system where every year we'll divide all the people in the country based on the initial letter of their last name, find out where the midpoint is. My guess is it's somewhere around Loudermilk. Okay? So from A to Loudermilk, they get $100,000 a year. And from Loudermilk on, they pay $100,000 a year. Now, the wonderful thing about that system is it's easy. All you need to know is their last name and the money gets transferred. But I think you'll agree that there are some other things about that system that don't strike you as right. Two, does the system deliver an appropriate amount of compensation? So we have the problem of undercompensation and the problem of overcompensation, both that we have to deal with. Most of the statistics that you read about the tort system, and by the tort system I mean a system which largely consists of automobile accidents. There's a lot of other kinds of things in there as well, but the main stuff of the tort system is automobile and other kind of roadway collisions. What we generally see in statistics there is that the small cases are generally overcompensated, and the people with large injuries are generally undercompensated. That's generally what the statistics tell us. That is probably not what a lot of you assume, because you read the paper, you hear the TV report, and for a variety of reasons, the press has had as one of its main agendas selling you on the fact that the tort system is spinning out of control. That there's these wacky juries that we ship in from Venus to give people $100 million for something that was their own fault. Okay? A lot of that, any time you try to make a conclusion from an anecdote, you want to be very careful. First of all, anecdotal evidence is tricky. Second of all, 90% of what you hear on TV and newspapers isn't even so. It didn't even happen the way they tell you. There were two very famous ones that you may have heard of. There was a story that a burglar recovered when he fell through a skylight of a building he was trying to burglarize. That happened out east, and the press played that up and down, and look at this loony system, look at these crazy lawyers. This guy's a burglar, and he falls through a skylight while he's burglarizing, and now he has some kind of an action against the owner of the building. Isn't that crazy? The fact was that it was a student who fell through the roof of a school that he was fixing. He was working for the school as a volunteer to fix it. And that's what really happened, but the press carries it as a burglar. The story was that a man was struck by a car while he was in a telephone booth and recovered from the telephone company. The fact was that he saw the car coming, he had about 20 seconds to get out, but the design of the door was such that on occasion, if you closed the door wrong, the door locked, and you couldn't open it from the inside. So that's a little more than you got from the news. And another example is the McDonald's hot coffee spill case, which I talked about when I was here 2 years ago. And we won't rehearse that again, except to say I asked people when they came in 2 years ago, how many people think the case was crazy? Almost everybody. I asked them at the end how many thought it was crazy. Hardly anybody. Because suddenly they get more facts about what happened. And it's not just somebody takes hot coffee and goes, I'm hurt, let's sue McDonald's. There was a whole lot more going on in that case.
Can you tell us a little about that? That's bothered me for years.
The real key to that case, in addition to a lot of sort of callousness that McDonald's executives showed while they were on the stand, they weren't very well trained. They said, a couple people get burned, what's it to us? That was bad to say with the jury there. But the main thing which the experts showed and which McDonald's knew ahead of time was there's hot and there's hot. We say hot coffee, we assume, coffee is hot, you get hot coffee. Restaurant coffee is served at 160 degrees. The hottest kind of takeout coffee was being served at about 180 degrees. McDonald's manual was telling them to give it out at 200 degrees. And what the burn experts were telling us is that when you go from 160 to 180, and then from 180 to 200, you dramatically and exponentially increase how quickly certain burns set in. So we go from second degree burns in 28 seconds at 160 to third degree burns in a second and a half at 200. They knew it and they said, but people are they going to take it to work? They want it to be hot when they get to work, so that's why we have to overheat it. So it wasn't hot coffee, it was what the industry calls superheated coffee. And so we talk about the risk of superheating the coffee. You add to the fact that McDonald's had at that point, by the time that case happened, 350 complaints nationwide. So they already knew that this was not the first case. They had a lot of knowledge of that. Number three, transaction costs. That is, what does it cost to drive the system? How many of the dollars that are put into the system to pay for people who are hurt actually get to people who are hurt? In the tort system, this is one of the biggest downsides. 44 cents of every premium dollar or other kind of input dollar that goes into the system, which you pay for all kinds of insurance. But for automobile liability insurance, 44 cents on each dollar gets to an accident victim. The rest of it is torn up in administering the system itself. Some of that, of course, goes to lawyers. Some of that goes to expert witnesses. Some of that goes for court costs and driving the system generally. Why is it so, why are the administrative costs so high? In part because it has to find out so much. It cares whether people are at fault or not. It cares whether they're negligent. It takes some time to know that kind of thing. Fourth, how does the system do in terms of preventing or reducing accidents? That is, what's its deterrent effect? A lot of the systems we're going to look at, which look very good in terms of doing these other things, take a totally socialized system, which some countries have. We're going to talk more about that later. Where if you're hurt, all your medical bills are paid for out of the big pot, and we all pay into that pot through taxation. So like socialized medicine, socialized accident insurance, right? That's fine. That gets the money delivered, low transaction costs. All you have to show is you're hurt, present your doctor bills, and they pay for it, right? But who has an incentive now to be careful? If you're in a place where you're creating risks to other people, why would an employer make the machines that the workers work on safer? Doesn't help them to make it safer because the payment's the same regardless. Same thing for manufacturers, right? We'll talk a little bit more about that. But that's a big one. Does the system have any kind of capacity for reducing the amount of accidents or preventing the amount of accidents? And fifth, is the system widely seen as fair? A big part of what drives the current tort system is a very deep sense of justice that people shouldn't have to pay for the hurts of others unless they were at fault in producing them. That is, people don't see as just at a very deep level the idea of a mere transfer of money for purely economic reasons. They want to see a justice reason. They want to say, you have to be wrong. What did I do wrong? What should I have done better? Right? So the system has to be widely seen as fair. During the 70s and 80s, during the first wave of tort reform, defendants generally, the people who tended to get sued, and I'm now talking about institutional defendants like manufacturers and employers, generally saw or generally believed that the system wasn't fair or was paying too much, and the verdicts were getting crazy. By the way, the statistics on the number of lawsuits filed, how do you think they're going? More? Less? Same? Slightly down. Each 5-year increment over the last 25 years, slightly down. But that's not what you hear from the public press, is it? It's spinning out of control. There's more lawsuits. They're crazier lawsuits. The number of lawsuits is going down. And it's going even down in absolute numbers in a population which is rising. So you would expect it to go up a little bit just because there's more people, they're living closer together, they have more interaction moments where accidents can happen. Yeah.
How about the complexity of the lawsuits filed?
Some are a little more complex now when we get into some of the mass tort cases or some of the toxic tort cases. If you have a toxic tort case or a class action lawsuit, yes, that will be more complicated. But never because of the legal issues, always because of the scientific issues. Things like causation and tracing a particular illness to a particular alleged toxin. Right? If you want to read a book, a wonderfully written book, about bringing a major toxic tort action, read a book called A Civil Action by Jonathan Haar about a case in Massachusetts in which the allegation was that the water system was contaminated by a variety of plants. And the story is basically told from the standpoint of the lawyer who brought the action, and in the process lost his practice, lost his family, basically lost his mind, lost the case, right? Because the perils of proving causation in those kind of difficult scientific cases are enormous. Again, the legal theory in those cases is easy. Is the cause of your illness this? At the factual level, proving that's enormously difficult. Yes, ma'am?
Well, in that particular book, what I struggled with was the instructions to the jury given by the judge.
Right.
And so, having no exposure to anything else, is that typical as what was in that book, or was that more of an aberration?
The law is vague enough in these areas that the judge can always put a little of himself or herself in there. The idea that a judge is a totally impartial person mediating over everything is, you know, when you open the judge up, there's not dais. You know, there's organs like the rest of it, and there's enough room in there for the judge to bring that to an action. It's probably a little less so in civil cases. Judges usually bring a little more of a political viewpoint to a criminal case because in many states judges are elected. And guess what? The electorate wants all the criminals put away, right? And so judges tend to have a little bit of a prosecutive bias. And there's some other artifacts for that. A lot of them were prosecutors at one time, so they have a background that way. But yeah, it's not unusual to find a set of instructions which sort of lead the jury in one direction rather than another. Sometimes the judge is upset with the kind of case. The judge has a political theory that this case doesn't fit into. Sometimes the judge just hates the lawyer that's bringing the case. And you noticed that in that book, didn't you? Every time there was a hearing, the judge looked for an opening to bang him over the head. And, yeah.
What about the hidden costs? I'm thinking of like fraud and liability cases and insurance costs. And my example is the Cessna Airplane Company charged about $25,000 per plane for its product in 1970. By 1980, they were paying $60,000 per
right.
plane just for insurance.
Right. Right.
What about those hidden costs?
We're going to talk a little bit about that in the sort of first wave of tort reform, which tried to address some of those problems. But yes, when you have a manufacturer, especially, the manufacturer has to make some predictions about what the likelihood of lawsuits over this product are going to be in the long term, what the likelihood of winning or losing them are. And frankly, it doesn't matter a whole lot whether you win them or lose them. Just the fact that they're brought has to be calculated in there. And then through a combination of laying off the risk with insurance when that's possible. But I know you know situations where the risk isn't even insurable anymore, right? But if you can lay off an insurance fine, and then you set up at the accounting level some contingency funds to do that. And of course, the assumption is that it's passed through on the price of the product.
What I'm wondering is, you know, you're saying the number of suits are filed, therefore maybe the system is running out of control. And I wonder if, in fact, we had a lot of hidden costs and a competitive factors where we're buying a lot of insurance that other competing countries are not, for example.
Yeah, that becomes a different sort of problem. So long as all of the competitors in a particular industry are under the same general umbrella of law, even though it varies a little from state to state, it's pretty consistent. And most of them are also regulated heavily by federal regulation, so that's, of course, consistent. But when you begin to compete with industries and companies that are not subject to that sort of umbrella and are elsewhere, then you have a different problem. Right? Then you get into some sort of anti-competitive sorts of issues. Yeah. Okay, let's look at the systems that we've got operating today. We start with the tort system. And I want to make it clear that we don't have a pure tort system. What we have working today is a very odd combination of a tort system and an insurance system. And a lot of the decisions that you hear that maybe you say, that doesn't seem right, they're not really driven by a tort idea, they're driven by an insurance idea. What if you're on a jury, you're not quite sure if the plaintiff should bear this loss, let's say it's a heavy economic loss, $150,000. You don't particularly want to saddle the poor defendant with it either. The defendant is someone you can identify with, he just drove his car and maybe he was careless and maybe he wasn't, but he wasn't terribly careless, right? But if you know that this defendant is carrying insurance, you begin to look at that case differently. You begin to look at it not so much from the sort of moral standpoint of torts, who's at fault, who's most at fault, but you begin to look at it from a more economic standpoint. Now, it is not true that insurance companies have an endless reserve of money. They don't print it, so far as I know. It's not that. I mean, some people may think that way, but that's just kind of an ignorant way to think about it, that it's an insurance company, so nobody pays. But I think what most people understand is that this is a form of socializing the risk among all of us, that insurance is a way for all of us to put in small amounts of money, and then the people who are terribly hurt can pull out big amounts of money. Of course, when the insurance pools get askew, then we have some other kinds of pathologies. Okay, the tort system. That has intentional torts. We're not going to pay any attention to those. It has two basic other theories. One we'll call negligence, which is basically sorting out risks. What we're basically saying is it reasonable to expose another person to that much risk? Risk, there's a variety of ways of doing the calculus here, but one way of thinking about risk is with this sort of little algebraic formula, R equals C divided by U, where C means the chances of injury, including the amount of those injury, and U equals the utility of the conduct. That is, the very conduct which creates a risk to others has a social utility. When we build a skyscraper in Chicago, if it's a certain height, we may know statistically that we're going to kill 0.8 people. Or 1.3 people. The tables will tell us this. Our experience will tell us this. So why do we build it? Because we need the skyscraper. Right? Why do you drive from point A to point B when you know that that's riskier than sitting home in your chair? Sitting home in your chair is not risk-free, but it's got lower risk than driving from point A to point B. Why? Because you want to get to point B, because it has utility. And you do it as carefully as you can, but that's the basic question that most tort cases are about. Economists know this as cost-benefit analysis. Right? It's trade-offs. If you want this, you're going to have to suffer this. We talked about that a little last week in terms of the Constitution. Right? If you want certain things, they always come at a price. It's a wonderful old line from Inherit the Wind from Scopes Monkey Trial. How many of you have seen that with Spencer Tracy playing Clarence Darrow? And he talks about all human progress having this cost. And he talks about God sort of talking to us as we do it. And the line that I just love is, yes, you may fly your airplanes to get from point A to point B faster. But the birds will lose their wonder and the clouds will smell of gasoline. There it is. You want this, you get it. But you pay it. And we're learning more and more from ecologists about a lot of these downsides that Americans used to not care. You know, if you can do it, let's just do it. If it's doable, we have to do it. That was the morality of America, you know, for a while there. And now we're beginning to see that all of these things have long-range costs. So that's negligence. I got some fun statistics here on about people getting killed in accidents. But there's some interesting statistics. These run the range from 87 to 96, the most recent statistics I could get. These are the number in America of accidental death trends. So these are death cases. They have other charts for pure injury, but this is a nice window into it. We go from 95,000 in 87 to 93,000 in 96. So the overall amount of the death trend is down. When we get to motor vehicles, and that collects a number of things, truck accidents, bike accidents, etc., that goes from 48,000 to 43,000, so that's down. Why is that? A lot of reasons for that. We're more careful. We're more sensitized to it. Vehicles are safer. I don't know, Dick, is it fair to say that safety sells better than it used to? Consumers didn't used to think about safety when they bought. They thought about speed, color, pizzazz. And, you know, today they think about those things, but they also think about the safety of the vehicles. Ask yourself why you see so many people driving around with sports utility vehicles when they live in Indiana. Yeah. What are you going to do? Drive across a lawn? You know, there's no hills.
It's for the speed bumps at the mall.
But yeah, right. That's right. Well, that's a lot of that has to do with a feeling of safety. It's a big car. In fact, one of the things that that is true is that our road statistics have always been worse than certain European countries. Even though in European countries they drive, from my experience, at 300 miles an hour. Is because we have a different kind of vehicle mix. Yes. A lot of heavy ones, a lot of small ones, and this and that, and boy, you get in the wrong end of that one. And when people buy these SUVs, what they're saying is, I want on the right end of that mix. But in Europe, most of the cars are small. And so even when they hit each other, you don't get you get injuries, but you don't get as many death injuries. So motor is down from 48,000 to 43,000. Here's work-related deaths. From 11,000 in 87 to just under 5,000 in 96. Why is that? Better technology, more sensitivity to it, and more regulation. A lot more regulation.
Could it also be because of the change in the type of industry that...
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
The old steel mills and all that stuff are giving way to high-tech stuff.
That's right. And even the mills themselves have fewer sort of human beings capable of being hurt there because it's more mechanized. But yes, it's a different and less dangerous kind of atmosphere in the workplace. Home, from 21,000 to 26,000. So it's going up in the home. I don't know if we're getting more careless in the home or what. But we do know one thing, the home is one place where there's sort of no regulations, really, that have much of an effect. Also, there's the problem of maybe you're just more comfortable there. You think less about this and that. Or maybe a lot of it is like me. I wanted to save money, so when I added a room, I did the electric wiring. And about a year later, I had to have another line put in for something else for a computer, and I wanted a big line, and I wanted to be right, so I hired an electrician to come in. He walked in, he took one look up, and he said, "Who did this?" And I said, I did. And he goes, oh, that's okay. You have to live here. But if an electrician had done that, I would have had his license. So maybe that's why the home thing is up. But motor is down a little. Work is down a lot. Home is down. Now, home is up. Now, another really, I thought, interesting set of statistics here is they undertook to measure, based on activities with regular exposure, that is, if you engaged in this activity in sort of a regular way over the course of your life, what are the odds of dying at some point over your lifetime from this activity? And here's the list they give you. Lightning strike, it's a beauty, right? We always say, that's like lightning strike, right? Ski racing, one beer a day, boating accident, car accident, air show flying, parachuting, hang gliding, heavy drinking, smoking a pack a day, living with a smoker, home accidents, scuba diving. And they give you one in a particular number. What would you guess is the highest on that list, your best odds of not dying this way?
Smoking.
No, best odds. Least likely to die from this. Sorry.
Struck by lightning.
Struck by lightning. Okay, that's the kind of paradigm. One in 30,000 deaths from struck by lightning. The worst odds?
Smoking
a pack a day. One in six is what they're now measuring. That is pack a day over your whole life.
What's the one in six?
Smoking a pack a day.
No. One chance in...
six.
Six what?
That's what'll kill you.
Killing you, that's what'll kill you.
That's what'll kill you.
But that's six people that smoke.
Yes, that's right. One in six who engage in this activity regularly.
Within what period of time?
What's
the story?
Yeah. Actually, it's more dangerous than air show flying, which is only one in ten. Hang gliding is 1 in 100. Living with a smoker is 1 in 700. Home accidents, 1 in 130. Car accident, 1 in 60. 1 in 60. Yeah, it's a pretty low number. One beer a day, 1 in 1,000. So, sort of odd statistics there. All right. That's one system. Then we've got the system of private insurance. And we all know basically how that works, except the most interesting thing about, first of all, private insurance legally is what we call the no-fault system. It's based strictly on a contract. That is, an insurance company undertakes that if this happens, we pay. You know, and there's no fault involved. You know, your house burns down and you go to the fire insurance company and you say, give me the money, and they say, well, wait a minute. We want to think about this. Maybe you started. Maybe you could have been more careful. Or maybe somebody else was negligent. And the answer is, that's not the kind of insurance we're talking about. You've undertaken to pay when this happens. And by the way, when the fire insurance company says, what did we do wrong? What did we do wrong? We were nowhere near your house. We can prove it. The theory isn't that they did anything wrong. The theory is they made a promise. And they got paid for it. So that's a whole different legal theory. That's a contractual idea. You make a promise, you fulfill it, right? And, you know, they better make the promises correctly and in the right amount, or they go out of business, right? But that's how private insurance works. There's an incredible, though, combination between torts and private insurance. Let me give you this one. You are at fault, and you run into and hurt someone who's not carrying insurance. They collect from you, because we're assuming you're carrying liability insurance, right? And so if you hurt them and it's your fault, they collect from your insurance company. They can do that even though if they hit you, you can't collect from them because they're not participating in the insurance system. They haven't bought any insurance. But the mere fact that they're not in the pool doesn't mean that they don't get to go into the pool when you hit them. As a matter of fact, it's worse than that. Most of us buy separate riders and pay money for them to protect ourselves against being hit by these guys who don't have any. And there's always a student when we talk about this problem. This is called the non-reciprocity of insurance and liability insurance, and it's a real problem. There's always a student who goes, oh, but the people who aren't carrying insurance certainly will be more careful. Because they're not carrying insurance, so they picture them like this. I say, you know, is that your experience? Is that the people who are not carrying insurance? Is that the group you want your life in the hands of? How does that work? And of course, what many states have done now is to try to regulate this by making it illegal to not have insurance. And they require, a lot of states now require all kind of proof that you have insurance before you can get a license. Right? Of course, surprise, surprise, you can drive without a license. All you need is a key and a car and a body, and you can drive without a license, not legally, but you can drive without a license, and they do hit people.
And you can cancel their insurance.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing about private insurance that's interesting is most of us are buying the same insurance twice. Right? We buy insurance for us to be hurt in a collision, even though we're buying into a system where the person at fault is supposed to pay us if we're hurt. So we have a big double coverage problem here. What happens is you can get a certain amount of money out of your insurer if you get hurt, regardless of whose fault it is. Then you can turn around and try to sue the third person too. And now it depends on the state whether you can get actually paid twice for the same injury. What usually happens is when you get the money from the other guy's carrier, your carrier that already paid you is subrogated and it gets some of that money back, so they get paid back. So that's what I mean when I say we're buying a lot of extra insurance. And then we might even have purchased health insurance to cover the same kind of thing. So we may have bought the same insurance three times. Then we get public insurance systems. Anybody think of any?
Workers' comp.
You're all in them. Workers' comp I want to deal with separately because that's another form of a private system. Think of any public insurance systems that you're in? You're in them whether you want to be or not. That's why they're public.
Social Security.
Social Security disability, right. And so that's paid out of the public fisc, right? Tax dollars, et cetera, go in, a certain amount is set aside. And then if you meet certain criteria, you can collect from that fund. And you don't need to prove fault. It's not a tort idea. It's an insurance idea, but it's public. And what's the other big one?
Medicare,
Medicaid. We're going to come back to them. And I was thinking also of unemployment compensation. Unemployment compensation is an insurance against loss of job, right? And that's a public system. You know, you can raise your hand and say, I choose not to pay into that. And they go, you know, we're sorry. It's not a private system. It's a public. It's a public system. Workers' comp's an interesting one. Every state has some form of workers' compensation, although certain industries are exempted. The agricultural industry for a long time was exempt from workers' compensation. Do you want to know on what theory?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Can you guess?
Too high risk?
Huh? Yeah. No theory.
Expensive.
Congress knew. They didn't want it. The agriculture didn't want it. And the agricultural belt congressmen weren't going to vote for it unless they exempted agricultural. And so some things are based on principle and some things are based on politics. And I don't mean politics in a bad way. I just mean there's political interest. So agriculture was generally exempted. We generally exempt in most states companies that employ fewer than, say, 8 people or 10 people. So there's a lot of sort of small company exemptions. What's the big trade-off in workers' compensation? Well, the big trade-off is this. This goes back to this kind of thing here. First of all, we make it easier for the worker because there are certain things the worker does not have to prove. It won't block the worker if it was his own fault. So we get rid of what we call contributory negligence, which is plaintiff's negligence in the tort system. So even if the worker was careless, wasn't watching, and let his hand go onto the punch press, doesn't hurt him. In the system. It hurts his hand, but it doesn't hurt him in the system, right? Or if he's hurt by a fellow worker. There used to be a thing called the fellow servant rule. If you were hurt by another worker for the same business, the business didn't have to pay for that. You went after the fellow servant. So workers' comp said, okay, no more contrib, no more fellow servant rule, and here's the biggie, you don't have to show that the employer was at fault. It's a no-fault system. What you have to show is you were hurt on the job. Now, what's the trade-off? The damages are different. They're calculated differently. They're smaller. They mainly compensate out of pocket, medical expenses, loss of wages, etc. There's some payment in there for a loss of function, permanent or temporary. But the big megillah is there's no pain and suffering money. You don't get any money for the pain and suffering. And that raises a very interesting question. The tort system, when it decides how much compensation to give, asks the jury to compensate for the amount of pain and suffering. Interesting question. What's the function of a system that pays for pain and suffering? What do you make of it? Do you like it? Sometimes that's where these awards get pretty big, right? I saw a lawyer one time, and lawyers know how to play this, and there's the jury there. It was a simple little case. It was a busted rib case. And a busted rib case is usually not a very big case. You can't do anything with a busted rib other than tape the guy up, and he hurts for a couple of months, and then he's fine, right? There's not a lot of surgery. There's not a lot of bills. But this lawyer got to the jury, and he's got pain and suffering, and he says, I want you to think about how many times a day you breathe. Because every time he breathes, he has pain. So I'd like you to get out your pencils and papers, your calculators, and think about how many times he endures this pain. Okay. Now, how much money do you get for pain and suffering? Let me tell you, that's mostly a function of who's on the jury. Okay? Go down to a rural county and get a bunch of farmers. I want money for pain and suffering. My hand hurts. You know, they're farming with two broken legs. Right? They've been living with pain since they were 18 years old. They don't hear that, but, you know, different kind of population on the jury, you get a different kind of result there. And there's also, of course, people have very different notions about how much money is a lot of money. So you get those kinds of differences as well. So that's the basic workers' comp trade-off, and we got that basically as part of the progressive movement in the early part of this century. And it's interesting. Many people will say, if they want you to buy into a new system, they'll say, this will be a great system. It'll be just like workers' comp. And other people will say, boy, we won't own and have that system. We'll get the same thing as we got with workers' comp. That is the only thing they disagree with it about is whether the system is good or bad. Right? And that's sort of a function of where you are and whether that system works for you or doesn't work for you. Or as the saying goes, everything in law depends on whose ox gets gored, right? Where are you? How does the system work for you? The first wave of tort reform in the 80s basically is when it was in high sale. Let me give you some of the things that have happened. In most of the states that you live in, much of this is probably already in place. First of all, caps on recovery. Limitation to the amount of money that the plaintiff can get for compensatory damages. In many states now, it is limited to 3 times, as a maximum, the amount of out-of-pocket expenses. So that's a way of limiting how much the jury can run with pain and suffering. You take your medical bills, you take your lost wages, all of the things that are liquidated and measurable out-of-pocket, and then the judge tells the jury, once you find out what they are, you may not bring in a compensatory verdict of more than 3 times that amount. Is that fair? Well, I don't know. It depends. There are some cases where we have very small amount of out-of-pockets and very big pain and suffering, if it's the kind of injury you can't do much for. You have others where you have a lot of bills, but very little pain and suffering doesn't really get in the way, but it just takes a lot of money to fix this particular kind of problem. So it works unevenly, but it's a start. They have limited, in most states now, punitive damages. And punitive damages, which was designed to punish the defendant, were the cases where you would get the really huge numbers, which you would read in the paper. Okay. Where the juries would come back and they'd find that compensatory damages, that is the amount of actual damage, was $2 million, but will sock the defendant with $100 million in punitive damages. And you say, why are those numbers so high? That's crazy. The jury has lost their mind. Well, the theory of punitive damages is it has nothing to do with making the plaintiff whole. It's a kind of an outgrowth from the criminal system. You've got to punish the defendant. You've got to make the defendant feel it. And now suddenly what's on the table? How rich is the defendant? You know? You sock me for $10, you can hurt me with just $10, right? But I don't want to lose the 10. But a large company, the way the jury got to the verdict in McDonald's, which the judge set back, okay? Mrs. Liebeck ended up getting 60,000 plus 480, so 640,000 was the final verdict after the judge got done with it. But the jury had come up with 3.2 million initially. You know how they got there with the punitive damages? The lawyer for the plaintiff shared with them what McDonald's daily gross intake on coffee sales was. Is it too much for this woman who has the rest of her life with this pain and these 30 skin grafts to ask McDonald's to give her one day of their profits? Pretty powerful argument, right? You know, when it worked, the lawyer's in the back room going, why didn't I say a week? What was wrong with a month, right? One of the best moments of a colleague's life who does a lot of this sort of case is when the jury came back and they didn't have a verdict in one of these cases. They had a question for the judge. And he said, yes, what's your question? And they said, may we have a calculator? In the jury. You see, four plaintiff's lawyers tripping over themselves to get their calculator to the jury first. And look, it has 32 numbers on this side of the decimal point. Let's get them the big one. So that's changed. Usually now what we're doing is we're limiting punitive damage to three times compensatory. That's the fairly common statutory pattern. So whatever the compensatory damages is, the punitive damages cannot be more than three times that. And what's happening, what's happened in Indiana and Illinois and a number of other states is this one. See if you like this one. When you get your punitive damages, the plaintiff and the plaintiff's lawyer gets 25% of it. 75% of it goes to the state, and it goes into a fund, usually for some designated purpose. You like that? You're being employed by the state, and they ain't paying you. You're doing their work. You're bringing the lawsuit, your resources, you're bringing the work, and then turning the money over. Yeah.
So 25% goes to the plaintiff and the plaintiff's lawyer.
Right.
So what does the plaintiff get of that 25%?
Typically, if the case goes all the way to trial, in most states the arrangement is a contingent fee with the attorney getting a third. So what will happen is the expenses of the lawsuit will be paid back first, and often the lawyer has a lot of his or her own money on the expense side of that. After the expenses are paid back, then usually one-third to the attorney. That's a fairly standard one. Sometimes you see a 25%. In some states now, we're beginning to limit that. And they're looking at limitation on contingent fee contracts. And maybe it'll be a third up to a certain number. And then after that, it'll have to go down. Because I think, you know, when the plaintiff gets something like $100 million, and we think of the lawyer getting a third of that, we want to know, how did the lawyer own a piece of that injury so much that he or she gets that much money? So there's some movement along those. Another part of the 80s tort reform is administrative review systems. In other words, taking some of these cases not to ordinary lay juries, but taking them to panels made up of experts in the field, particularly is this happening in medical malpractice cases, where instead of taking it to a jury, the case at least first has to go through a panel of healthcare professionals. And the thought there is that they better understand the problems of the doctors, they better understand what's at stake, what the medical risks are, what the trade-offs look like, right? There are a lot of medical procedures where most of us would choose to have them because the recovery rate is very good, but this particular procedure kills 1 in 100 that have the procedure. And no way to tell ahead of time who they are. If you're the one, you're thinking lawsuit, right? And it's hard for the jury to sort of see past the fact that this person got hurt, et cetera, et cetera. But, and you try to educate them about informed consent and everything else, but even so, there's some slippage. So we see a lot of move to administrative review systems. New kinds of time cutoffs. This is one that we were talking about, not looking up the other day. Statute of limitations. A plaintiff only has so much time to bring a lawsuit after the plaintiff is hurt, right? Usually that's 2 years. So usually if you're hurt in an accident, starting at the time you're injured, right? You have 2 years to bring the action, okay? And the idea of the 2 years is to get on with it, right? They can close the books, they can sign off on the insurance. You have an incentive to bring the case as early as possible and get a resolution of it. But here's the problem. In products cases, there is often an incredible delay between the release of the product on the market and the time the product gives the injury. The product might be 20 years old, it might be 30 years old, right? And by this point in time, the state of the art might have gotten to the point where we wouldn't build it this way anymore, but it's still out there, and people use it. And now let's say, and this was your airplane case, I think, the person gets hurt 25 years after the product is manufactured, has 2 years from the time he or she is hurt to bring the action, and try to persuade a jury that the product was defectively made. Right? It's just a design defect case, something wrong with it. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Remember, if you get to the jury, they're pretty sympathetic, right, to the plaintiffs if you can get the case that far. So what some states said was, we're going to have a different kind of time cutoff that doesn't start with when the product hurts the plaintiff. It starts with when the product is released on the market. Now, these statutes are longer than 2 years. They're often 10 years or 15 years. Right? And the idea of that, of course, is to make planning possible at the corporate level, right? To know when you can release your reserves, to know how to insure it, etc. But what that means is some people get hurt, and there's no period of time within which they can bring the action, because they get hurt after this other statute is already run. So that was another part of the reform package. Joint and several liability. This is a little bit of a complicated one, but a real important one. Imagine this situation. Here's the plaintiff, and the plaintiff gets hurt through the joint negligence of defendant one and defendant two. In other words, both defendant one and defendant two are negligent. Okay? Let's assume for our purposes that the plaintiff wasn't negligent at all. Sometimes the plaintiff also is some percentage negligent. Right? And let's say that 70% of the negligence belongs to defendant one and 30% from defendant two. The old rule was that defendant one and defendant two are what was called jointly and severally liable for the whole damage, which means the plaintiff could get 100% from any one, either one of them. Then the one who paid, in turn, could sue the other one for what was called contribution. So defendant one would pay 100% to the plaintiff and then get 30% of it back from defendant two. If defendant two paid the 100%, he could get it back from defendant one. Notice, who runs the risk of one of these defendants being not identifiable, not solvent? The other defendant. So if defendant two has gone bankrupt, defendant one pays the 100%. The tort reform package says, no, the liability is not joint and several. The liability is just each responsible for his own percentage. That means if defendant two is bankrupt and there's no money to get from defendant two, all the plaintiff will get is 70% from defendant one. Because the liability is not joint and several. That's bad enough for plaintiffs, and plaintiff lawyers, of course, hate this. They just go nuts when they hear this. But the other part of that package is, even if the defendants are not parties to the lawsuit, sometimes because they're immune, right? Like a city that might be immune. The jury can still say, what percentage of the fault belonged to this non-party who's not even in the courtroom, and subtract that from what the plaintiff gets. I think you're getting the picture that reform in the 80s all was in one direction. Right? And reform is a funny word. We always give it a positive spin, you know, especially if you're a Lutheran. The Reformation, right? There's always a positive spin to reform, but reform isn't a word that's necessarily positive. It just means it's reformed. Maybe you like the new way better, maybe you like the old way better. I have a colleague who calls the Tortfeasor Protection Acts. I mean, because that was the movement of tort reform in the 80s, because of this perceived terrible problem in the insurance industry. A lot of risks were uninsurable. And there are examples of that. For a three-year period, no one would sell you insurance to put up a child's slide in a public playground higher than 10 feet. You could not buy the insurance. They would not calculate the risk. There were places in this country out in the West where women had to drive, depending on where they live, sometimes 1,000 miles to find an obstetrician because the insurance rates for OBGYNs was off the charts. And so a lot of doctors just went out of the business. Or they would go to the next metropolitan area where they could get into a hospital and get under cover of the hospital's insurance umbrella, right? So there were distortions in the insurance industry and in the tort industry which drove this. Okay, well, what's the next wave of tort reform, the big one? My guess is that what we're going to play with over the next 20 years is some kind of a system which combines private and public insurance systems as a major replacement for the tort system. Probably this will happen more quickly in automobile situations than any other, because automobile situations are particularly easy to deal with, and I'll tell you why. They always involve what's called reciprocal risks. That's what makes automobile driving different from, say, being an employer or being a manufacturer of goods. Why are you careful when you drive your car? In large part, because you're in it. And the risks are reciprocal. If you're creating a risk to the other car, that driver is creating a risk to you. In other words, you're each creating a risk to each other. That means you each become caretakers, not just for the safety of others, but the safety of yourselves. You know, what if we did away with the tort system? Would you suddenly drive 150 miles an hour with your eyes closed, not watching? No, because it's not the fear of liability which is mainly making you careful in the first place. It's that you're at risk and you're causing risk to others and you don't want to. But the no-fault systems don't work very well in situations where we don't have this reciprocity of risks, right? The consumer doesn't present any kind of risk to the manufacturer, like the manufacturer creates for the consumer. The employee very seldom creates risks to the employer, anything like the risks that the employment causes to the employee. So those systems are not quite so good at a no-fault resolution. But I think we may be headed towards something like the system New Zealand has, some other countries have, which basically is socializing all the risks into a kind of a first-party insurance system. My guess is that there'll be a kind of a baseline that covers everybody, whether they buy into it or not. That'll be funded through ordinary tax revenues. But there'll then be the options to buy more through private insurance systems. Okay. If you want to picture it, you can picture it a little bit the way HMOs and PPOs work, right? You can buy into those systems at a certain level, although now I want to picture you having to buy into it. It's like socialized medicine, right? But if you want more, you can buy more. I think we're going to have for a long time a strange combination of public and private systems. But the nice thing about those systems is they don't have many facts to find out. It's just, are you hurt? Is it legitimate? Will probably in those systems either eliminate or greatly reduce pain and suffering and do compensation based on out-of-pockets and other measurables. The transaction costs will go way down. These systems tend to deliver anywhere from 70 to 90% on the premium dollar. And some of the better ones are over 90%. So very, very efficient kinds of systems.
Is that like workman's comp then?
Hmm?
Would that be a similar thing to workman's comp?
Similar. Only it would be mandatory and government funded and government collected and driven. Workers' comp is a publicly required private insurance system, but this would be a totally public system. Yes, it would be much more like workers' comp than what we have. But the big problem is number four with that system. That's the big problem. Four and five. Okay. Four. How do we reduce accidents when we have a no-fault system? And you're not going to like the answer. You have to combine the no-fault system with a regulatory system. You have to regulate these activities because the tort system is no longer regulated. So what do we see in workers' comp? We see OSHA. Because the workers' comp system sort of dried up the incentive over here for at some level. Not completely, because companies paid insurance hikes when they went up if they had too many injuries, but it was muffled, right? So what came in was government regulation in the form of OSHA to do accident prevention and reduction. And the other one is, will it be widely seen as fair? There is something, as I said before, that people say, I don't pay now unless I did something wrong. And that's the American way. By golly, that came with red, white, and blue, and no pay unless I'm at fault. You know, maybe. Or maybe. See, I say this to students, and whenever you say the word socialize this, we'll socialize the risk insurance, they always go, is that socialism? Are you a communist? And I say, in this country, we're all socialists. You buy insurance, you're a socialist. You want to go back to a pure non-socialist system? The river went by you earlier this century. But that is going to be seen as a drag on this. I mean, the politics of this, as you can expect, is going to be really nasty and really dirty. Why? First of all, let me give you some of the main players. The American Bar Association and plaintiff's lawyers. And they will tell you that this is bad for you. The truth is, it's bad for them. It may be bad for you, but that's not why they're telling you. The insurance lobby is going to tell you so, right? And all of these special interest groups are going to get involved, and they're each going to get their favorite congressman. Martin told me on the way down there was a fairly big tort reform package pending in Congress. Apparently got killed yesterday, at least for a year. But that was moving somewhat along the direction I was talking about. I didn't have all the particulars. Had something to do with the Republicans fighting with the Democrats. I think that's what it was. That was sort of the problem. Yeah, question. By the way, you can turn off the tape, but since it's 11:30, but I'll stay as long as you want. Yeah.
What's pushing the reform if you've got these big players with plenty of money who are resisting it?
The first wave of reform or the second wave of reform?
Yeah.
I think what will push it finally is that the system is so inefficient, we will finally see that it's just not delivering. And, you know, the system should have been reformed a long time ago. And in some states it was. But I think the reason it hasn't been reformed already is all of these powerful interest groups that are in it. Steve Sugarman, who teaches at Berkeley, has a really interesting way of doing it. In fact, I think they're test piloting this in some counties in California. Here's how you buy your auto insurance. Any of you know the system? Pay at the pump, auto insurance. That is, each gallon of gas has a tax connected to it, which goes into a big pot. And out of that pot, everybody gets paid who is hurt in an automobile accident. It has a lot of really interesting features. The more you drive, the more risk you create, the more money you kick into the pot. You don't buy any auto insurance. You buy gas. You want to drive, you got to have gas. Right. And of course, it might be 35 cents a gallon. It might be 40 cents a gallon. We don't know where it's going to come out. But it's more efficient than the tort system. Will it be widely seen as fair? You can imagine all kind of people who won't see it as fair, right? I use gasoline in my business, and I'm not running cars with it. I'm running machines with it. Well, so we'll have to figure out a way that those people get their gas other than at the pump, because it's not a tax on gasoline. It's a tax on gasoline that comes out of a pump into a car. Okay. Others will say, I drive a lot. But because I drive a lot, I'm more experienced, I actually generate less risk than the people who drive less often. Yeah, it could be. But no system is that precise. Every system takes very gross and rough surrogates to get at the right thing.
So you don't get anything on for good grades?
That's right. That's right. My guess is you could refine the system where, with a special card, you get to go to the good driver pump. Right? No, you could imagine this where the tax is only 20 cents because you have a special card that you won, right? Or if the kid's got more than a B average, he gets to go to the grade A pump, right? That's a little less than... Yeah, but all of the usual stuff that we can measure through insurance, yeah, this is a grosser solution.
Family with a lot of boys would be very happy.
Yeah, right.
Okay. But to get to that point, you have to determine fault again, right? Just the fact that somebody had seven accidents doesn't necessarily mean they're a bad driver. So you're back to the point, how do I get to the 20-cent pump versus the 40-cent pump?
That's right.
It's fault.
That's right. That's right. It could be that you get the special red card, which fits into the cheaper thing, if you have a record of 10 years without being in any accidents on either end of an accident. Could be.
Yeah.
But now you're right. Now we're building new cost into the system because now it has to track who's in all the accidents. Yes, sir.
What will this do with respect to waiting for a court date? Support that.
A big, big problem, which I didn't have time to talk about, a big, big problem with the tort system is delay. Yeah. It's got incredible delay built into it. Some of it's from the plaintiff's side. The plaintiff wants the case delayed because the plaintiff wants to find out how bad the injuries are going to be. And sometimes you don't know that for a while. The defendants, of course, want to delay it because then they don't have to pay the money out as soon. Right? One of the big things you're going to see in tort reform is this one. People are going to say, we know the loser in these cases pays the lawyers for both sides. That's the loser's pay doctrine. A lot of other countries have. Defendants are going to particularly say that, and what drives it is this perception of frivolous lawsuits. Well, if you have to pay when you lose, not just for your lawyer, but for the lawyer for the other side, and boy, can they charge, right? That's a real disincentive to bringing the lawsuit. What drove that politically was a perception that lawsuits were out of control. Of course, the problem is the numbers don't show that they're out of control. Why aren't they out of control? I'll tell you why. Lawyers bring them. They bring them mostly on the basis of a contingent fee, which means I'm buying into that case. They walk in and say, I bought a knife. I stuck the knife in my arm and I hurt myself. Let's sue the knife company. And I'm saying to myself as a lawyer, I want a third of this. I want to try to go sell the jury and spend a lot of my time to get a third of what they're going to give us. And so the lawyers do a lot more screening of the cases than you imagine. The image out there is lawyers are crazy to litigate. The truth is they spend a lot more time talking people out of lawsuits than talking into lawsuits.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Question?
Yes, sir.
You brought up the case of McDonald's, which I thought was very interesting because of the things I never heard before. But even a bigger case is Dow Corning on breast implants. And from everything I've read, silicone does not cause any of these medical problems, but they're paying off.
Yeah. They just settled that.
Do they?
How come they settled for that? Or did the jury say it?
It just talked about the amount of the award that some people would get up to $250,000, but they didn't know how to administer it.
I think the only way I can answer you to say is the question of whether or not silicone causes it is itself a controversial question. And that is the controversial question around those lawsuits.
Well, what I've read is it's been proven that it doesn't cause these problems, but what?
Read some more.
I read a lot of
it. Yeah, it depends on who you read, right? Because that is itself the controversial question. It was the same one. We had litigation that went on for 20 years over a drug called Bendectin. Did Bendectin cause birth defects in the children of the mothers who took it? Merrill Dow made it. They're probably still in litigation over that one. Does it? I don't know. Depends on which scientist you talk to. Depends on this whole... Cheryl, you could talk to us about the difference between correlation and cause, right? You can prove correlation in these cases, but can you prove cause? I don't know.
Where do the tobacco lawsuits fit into this?
Oh, boy. That we could do a whole day on tobacco lawsuits.
Well, are they intentional or negligent, or is it a mix?
We used to look at them as negligence lawsuits. Some of the documents that are being driven up now as a result of the government studies make us think that this is a lot deeper than negligence, that there was a lot of early knowledge about the potential. And that they hid the knowledge. There's all kind of cover-ups and this and that. But I'll tell you what hurt the traditionally what hurt the tobacco litigation is there's a defense in torts called assumption of risk. Well, from the moment the tobacco companies went in the 50s, I think, with the warnings on the package, they say, you know, we're warning you these have these dangerous potential. Now there's a doctrine called assumption of risk. I know about the risk. I agree to assume the risk. Now I can't sue you after that. But here's a key. Think about this one. The ETS cases, environmental tobacco smoke, secondhand smoke, assumption of risk doesn't work in those cases because those people didn't choose to smoke. So those are more dangerous lawsuits for the tobacco companies than the actual user. It's the people who got the secondary smoke. And of course, there's still an argument about how toxic is secondary smoke. I mean, the scientists are still fighting about whether we can trace causation from secondary smoke or not. Some studies say it's worse than primary smoke. Some studies say it's a lot safer.
It doesn't. That type of case doesn't fit into the private-public insurance, does it?
No.
At all?
It goes over here, and there's actually another problem here I didn't have time to talk about, which is called strict liability. There are certain kind of situations, and products are one of them, where even if the manufacturer wasn't negligent, if the product is defective, you still recover from that. That's an economic theory. But to say the product is defective is not a great deal different from saying it was negligently designed. It's not a great deal different. It's a little easier to prove, but not a lot easier to prove. So those are products cases, design defects. You get other products, though, that are like blood, for blood transfusions is one of them, and there are some other drugs that fit into a separate legal category called unavoidably unsafe. That is, our state of the knowledge is this drug will help a lot of people. Your choice whether to take it will tell you the problem, but it has this terrible side effect for 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, whatever. When that 1 in 1,000 gets hurt, they can't sue because the product is unavoidably unsafe. We don't want that product off the market. We want that product. Now, if we don't want them, if we don't need the product, if it isn't socially useful, I'll give you one: bungee jumper. You know, how do you defend that product? It's like the old lawn jarts. Remember lawn jarts? These things you threw, a little kid's game, they had steel points this long. They went off the market because there was no way to defend them. You could do the same thing without having the sharp points. You get the same utility out of it. Yes?
Given the lower transaction costs of a state-run system, I would think that a reform system would actually be an income generator for the state. Is there any talk about what might be done with this extra money?
Yes, and in the political realm, that's a large part of what the debate's going to be, is to the extent that this thing runs a profit, what will we use that for? If I want to sell it, you know what I'm going to say? This is my system. Let's say I have the pay at the pump system, and the excess, which I project, will be used for education. Education is always what you say. Every state has started a lottery. Let's have legalized gambling. Legalized gambling, you know, it's terrible, it's immoral, it's this and that. Oh, but we're going to use the money for education.
Right.
So you sell. Now, then what do? You take that money and you put it into the education budget, and then you take the same amount of money that was already in the education budget, and you take it out and you put it over here. Whatever. But, I mean, money is fungible, right? So you can put that money into education. I have people come into me all the time in my city, and they say, we don't like the fact that the city's doing this. I don't want any of my tax dollars to go for that. And I say, I can guarantee. Nobody knows what dollar goes where, but I know they pay so little, each person, that there's plenty of other places we can say we're spending it on. Yeah.
I want to get back to your example of a possible reform with medical malpractice and having a panel of experts before it goes to a jury. Has that happened yet?
Yeah.
Anywhere?
Yeah. But usually what happens is, the Indiana system is you got to take the case to the medical panel and you got to take it to conclusion. But if you don't like their outcome, then you can run it over into in front of a jury in a tort case.
I was just wondering if we had any good old boy system where the docs are protecting the other docs, whether or not
That's the danger. I mean, that's the downside of that, this sort of conspiracy there. But the panel isn't made up only of doctors. They're on it, and other kinds of experts are on it, and they do this for a 2 or 3 year period. But that's the danger. And the cure for the danger is to say, you got to go through that route, but you don't have to accept the result. You can then move over to the other.
Don't you have to sign a paper now before you get treatment in the hospital? In Washington, I think we do.
Oh, consent for care? Sure.
Well, consent to arbitration.
Yes. If you're going, if in many states now, you have to sign an arbitration agreement for certain kinds of disputes that they will be submitted not to the court system but to arbitration. That's right. What they're going to be challenged, though, in certain areas for highly public services, because if that's the only hospital, say, within 200 miles, the whole theory of that is that it's a contract. You've agreed ahead of time. Have you really?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
I always
that's the problem.
When I sign the paper.
Yeah, that's the problem. And so certain contracts will be voided if we see later that the person had no bargaining power whatsoever. They were just forced to sign. So that those cases are going to have that problem. Yeah.
Do you think we'd have a better justice system if we did away with the jury system?
Wow. I'll tell you what, I would say this. I could imagine putting a very sensible, reasonable argument together for getting rid of juries in civil cases. I would never want to let them go in criminal cases. I think they play too important a political role historically. The government against the person in a criminal case to get the populace represented in there. But in civil cases, I think you can put a very good argument together that juries don't help the system get better. Now, what you have to always be careful about there is the jury system has another very positive benefit, and that is the effect it has on the jurors themselves. They're part of the system. They feel an ownership. Is the system widely seen as fair? When it's a jury, it's more widely seen as fair because it's not legal experts, it's ordinary people. Every study that we look at, well, jurors tell us, 90% of them feel better about the system after they've been a juror than before. So the more people you sort of expose to the system, they watch it work, that sort of builds up public confidence in the system. But does the jury get it right? I don't know. We act, certainly the law acts as if the jury's going to make a lot of mistakes because we keep a lot of things away from the jury because we think they'll mishandle.
I was called for a U.S. district court on the jury, and I never did get on a jury, but this last time I went up and we sat around for a long time.
Yeah.
Finally, the judge came down and thanked us all.
Right.
He says, "You don't know what a service you've done." She says, "The fact that the jury was here..."
They settled the case.
Yeah,
they settled the case.
Yeah,
because the jury was there.
They didn't want to go to
right.
jury.
That's right.
Can we assume when we hear these terrible cases like the McDonald's case, the person that tried to commit suicide on the subway and hit the rail, and that those are being misrepresented by the...
You certainly want to be open to the possibility they're being misreported. I don't want to say you should assume they're being misreported. Some of them are being reported correctly. But just be aware that there's a...
Are very many happening that way then, I guess? What happened in the McDonald's case is...
I don't think there are. I don't think there are as many as we're led to believe, certainly.
I was hoping you'd say... Almost none of those happen.
Well, a lot of them didn't. Some of them do. Yeah. Juries get sold on odd things.
Well, you covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. A lot of ground, yeah.
That's really
it's a good group.
To have it makes me feel better about the system each time you talk, too.
This takes me a semester to do it.
Oh,
I'm going to get an hour.
It's a lot, yeah.